One of the more disagreeable things about talking to Roger Mack was that Jamie was sure he always told the truth. He'd forgotten to leave the duck at the cabin. Wiping it on his breeches, he pushed grimly through the sprouting weeds to hear what fate awaited him. Chapter 11. Blood Work. I pushed the microscope toward Bobby Higgins, who had returned from his errand, his own discomforts forgotten in worry for Lizzie. "See the round pinkish things?" I said. "Those are Lizzie's blood cells." "Everyone has blood cells," I added. "They're what make your blood red." "'Struth," he muttered, amazed. "I never knew." "Well, now you do," I said. "Do you see that some of the blood cells are broken, and that some have little spots in them?" "I do, Mum," he said, screwing up his face and peering intently. "What are they, then?" "Parasites. Little beasts that get into your blood if a certain kind of mosquito bites you," I explained. "They're called Plasmodium. Once you've got them, they go on living in your blood. But every so often, they begin to, breed. When there are too many of them, they burst out of the blood cells, and that's what causes a malarial attack. The ague. The sludge of the broken blood cells sort of silts up, you see, in the organs, and makes you feel terribly sick." "Oh." He straightened up, making a face of deep aversion at the microscope.
That's pure ghastly, that is."
"Yes, it is," I said, succeeding in keeping a straight face. "But quinine, Jesuit bark, you know, will help stop it."
"Oh, that's good, Mum, very good," he said, his face lightening. "However you do come to know such things," he said, shaking his head, "'tis a wonder."
"Oh, I know quite a lot of things about parasites," I said casually, taking the saucer off the bowl in which I had been brewing the mix of dogwood bark and gallberries. The liquid was a rich purplish black, and looked slightly viscous now that it had cooled. It also smelled lethal, from which I deducted that it was about ready. "Tell me, Bobby, have you ever heard of hookworms?" He looked at me blankly.
"No, Mum."
Would you hold this for me, please?" I put a folded square of gauze over the neck of a flask and handed him the bottle to hold while I poured the purple mixture into it. "These fainting fits of yours," I said, eyes on the stream. "How long have you had them?"
"Oh, 6 months, maybe."
"I see. Did you by chance notice any sort of irritation? Itching, say? Or a rash? Happening maybe 7 months ago? Most likely on your feet?" He stared at me, soft blue eyes thunderstruck as though I had performed some feat of mind-reading.
"Why, so I did have, Mum. Last autumn, 'twas."
"Ah," I said. "Well, then, I think, Bobby, that you may just possibly have a case of hookworms." He looked down at himself in horror.
"Where?"
"Inside." I took the bottle from him and corked it. "Hookworms are parasites that burrow through the skin, most often through the soles of the feet, and then migrate through the body until they reach your intestines." "Your, innards," I amended, seeing incomprehension cross his face. "The adult worms have nasty little hooked bills, like this." I crooked my index finger in illustration. "And they pierce the intestinal lining and proceed to suck your blood. That's why, if you have them, you feel very weak and faint frequently." From the sudden, clammy look of him, I rather thought he was about to faint now, and guided him hastily to a stool, pushing his head down between his knees. "I don't know for sure that that's the problem," I told him, bending down to address him. "I was just looking at the slides of Lizzie's blood, though, and thinking of parasites, and, well, it came to me suddenly that a diagnosis of hookworms would fit your symptoms rather well."
"Oh?"
he said faintly. The thick tail of wavy hair had fallen forward, leaving the back of his neck exposed, fair-skinned and childlike.
old are you, Bobby?" I asked, suddenly realizing that I had no idea.
23, Mum," he said.
"Mum, I think I shall have to puke."
I snatched a bucket from the corner and got it to him just in time.
"Have I got rid of them?"
he asked weakly, sitting up and wiping his mouth on his sleeve as he peered into the bucket.
"I could do it more."
"I'm afraid not," I said sympathetically. "Assuming that you have got hookworms, they're attached very firmly and too far down for vomiting to dislodge them. The only way to be sure about it, though, is to look for the eggs they shed."
Bobby eyed me apprehensively.
"It's not exactly as I'm horrible shy, Mum," he said, shifting gingerly. "You know that, but Dr. Potts did give me great huge clysters of mustard water. Surely that would have burnt they worms right out. If I was a worm, I should let go and give up the ghost at once, did anyone souse me with mustard water."
"Well, you would think so, wouldn't you?" I said.
"Unfortunately not. But I won't give you an enema," I assured him. "We need to see whether you truly do have the worms to begin with, and if so, there's a medicine I can mix up for you that will poison them directly."
"Oh."
He looked a little happier at that.
"How do you mean, to see them then, Mum?"
He glanced narrowly at the counter where the assortment of clamps and suture jars was still laid out.
"Couldn't be simpler," I assured him. "I do a process called fecal sedimentation to concentrate the stool, then look for the eggs under the microscope."
He nodded, plainly not following. I smiled kindly at him.
"All you have to do, Bobby, is shit."
His face was a study in doubt and apprehension.
"If it's all the same to you, Mum," he said, "I think I'll keep the worms."
Chapter 12. Further Mysteries of Science. Late in the afternoon, Roger Mackenzie came back from the cooper shop to discover his wife deep in contemplation of an object sitting on his dinner table.
"What is that? Some type of prehistoric Christmas tin goods?"
Roger extended a ginger forefinger toward a squat jar made of greenish glass and sealed with a cork, the latter covered with a stout layer of red wax. An amorphous chunk of something was visible inside, evidently submerged in liquid.
"Ho, ho," said his wife tolerantly, moving the jar out of his reach.
"You think you're being funny. It's white phosphorus, a present from Lord John."
He glanced at her. She was excited, the tip of her nose gone pink and bits of red hair pulled loose and waving in the breeze. Like her father, she was inclined to run her hands through her hair when thinking.
"And you intend to do what with it?"
he asked, trying to keep any note of foreboding from his voice. He had the vaguest memories of hearing about the properties of phosphorus in his distant school days. He thought either it made you glow in the dark, or it blew up. Neither prospect was reassuring.
"Well, make matches, maybe."
Her upper teeth fastened momentarily in the flesh of her lower lip as she considered the jar.
"I know how, in theory, but it might be a little tricky in practice."
"Why is that?"
he asked warily.
"Well, it bursts into flame if you expose it to air," she explained. "That's why it's packed in water. Don't touch, Jem. It's poisonous."
Grabbing Jemmy round the middle, she pulled him down from the table where he'd been eyeing the jar with greedy curiosity.
"Oh, well, why worry about that? It will explode in his face before he has a chance to get it in his mouth."
Roger picked up the jar for safekeeping, holding it as though it might go off in his hands. He wanted to ask whether she were insane, but had been married long enough to know the price of injudicious rhetorical questions.
"Where do you mean to keep it?"
He cast an eloquent glance round the confines of the cabin, which in terms of storage boasted a blanket chest, a small shelf for books and papers, another for comb, toothbrushes, and Brianna's small cache of personal belongings, and a pie hutch. Jemmy had been able to open the pie hutch since the age of 7 months or so. I'm thinking I'd better put it in Mama's surgery, she replied, keeping an absent-minded grip on Jem, who was struggling with single-minded energy to get at the pretty thing. Nobody touches anything in there.
That was true enough. The people who were not afraid of Claire Fraser personally were generally terrified of the contents of her surgery. These, featuring fearsomely painful-looking implements, mysterious murky brews, and vile-smelling medicines. In addition, the surgery had cupboards too high for even a determined climber like Jem to reach.
Good idea, Roger said,
anxious to get the jar out of Jem's vicinity.
I'll take it up now, shall I?
Before Brianna could answer, a knock came at the door, followed immediately by Jamie Fraser. Jem instantly ceased trying to get at the jar, and instead flung himself on his grandfather with shrieks of joy.
"Who is it, then, Awalach?" Jamie inquired amiably, neatly turning Jem upside down and holding him by the ankles. "A word, Roger Mac."
"Sure. You'll sit, maybe."
He told Jamie earlier what he knew, lamentably little, regarding the role of the Cherokee in the upcoming revolution. Had he come to inquire further? Reluctantly setting down the jar, Roger pulled out a stool and pushed it in his father-in-law's direction. Jamie accepted it with a nod, dexterously transferring Jemmy to a position over one shoulder and sitting down. Jemmy giggled madly, squirming until his grandfather slapped him lightly on the seat of his breeches, whereupon he subsided, hanging contentedly upside down like a sloth, his bright hair spilling down the back of Jamie's shirt.
"It's this way, Acharich," Jamie said. I must be going in the morning to the Cherokee villages, and there is a thing I'd ask you to do in my place.
Oh, aye? Do you want me to see to the barley harvest, then?
The early grain was still ripening. Everyone had his fingers crossed that the weather would keep fair for another few weeks, but the prospects were good.
No, Brianna can do that. If you will, lass.
He smiled at his daughter, who raised thick, ruddy eyebrows, the twins of his. I can, she agreed. What are you planning to do with Ian, Roger, and Archbug, though? Archbug was Jamie's factor, and the logical person to be overseeing the harvest in Jamie's absence.
Well, I shall take young Ian with me. The Cherokee can him well, and he's comfortable with their speech. I'll take the Beardsley lads, too. They can fetch back the berries and bits of things your mother wants for Lizzie straight away.
I go, too?
Jemmy inquired hopefully.
Not this time, Awalach. In the autumn, maybe.
He patted Jemmy on the bottom, then returned his attention to Roger.
That being so, he said, I need ye to go to Cross Creek, if you will, and collect the new tenants.
Roger felt a small surge of excitement and alarm at the prospect, but merely cleared his throat and nodded.
Aye, of course. Will they?
You'll take Archbug along, and Tom Christie.
A moment of incredulous silence greeted this statement.
Tom Christie?
Bree said, exchanging a glance of bafflement with Roger.
What on earth for?
The schoolmaster was a notably dour sort, and no one's idea of a congenial travelling companion. Her father's mouth twisted wryly.
Aye, well, there's the one small thing MacDonald neglected to tell me when he'd asked if I'd take them. They're Protestants, the lot.
Ah, said Roger. I see.
Jamie met his eye and nodded, relieved to be so immediately understood.
I don't see.
Brianna patted her hair, frowning, then pulled off the ribbon and began to comb her fingers slowly through it, undoing the tangles as a preliminary to brushing it.
What difference does it make?
Roger and Jamie exchanged a brief but eloquent glance. Jamie shrugged and pulled Jem down into his lap.
Well,
Roger rubbed his chin, trying to think how to explain 2 centuries of Scottish religious intolerance in any way that would make sense to an American of the 20th century.
Ah, You recall the civil rights thing in the States? Integration in the South, all that?
Of course I do.
She narrowed her eyes at him.
Okay. So, which side are the Negroes?
The what?
Jamie looked entirely baffled.
Where do Negroes come into the matter? Not quite that simple, Roger assured her. Just an indication of the depth of feeling involved. Let us say that the notion of having a Catholic landlord is likely to cause our new tenants severe qualms.
And vice versa? He asked, glancing at Jamie.
What's Negroes?
Jamie asked with interest.
Dark-skinned people,
Roger replied, suddenly aware of the potential quagmire opened up by this question. It was true that the term Negro didn't invariably mean also slave, but near enough that there was little difference.
Do you not remember them? From your great-auntie Jocasta's place?
Jemmy frowned, adopting, for an unsettling instant, the precise expression his grandfather was wearing.
No.
Well, anyway,
Bree said, calling the meeting to order with a sharp rap of her hairbrush on the table.
The point is that Mr. Christie is enough of a Protestant to make the new people feel comfortable?
Something of the sort,
her father agreed, one side of his mouth curling up.
Between your man here and Tom Christie, at least they'll not think they're entering the devil's realm entirely.
I see, Roger said again, in a slightly different tone.
So it wasn't only his position as son of the house and general right-hand man, was it? But the fact that he was a Presbyterian, at least in name. He raised a brow at Jamie, who shrugged in acknowledgement.
Mm-hmm, Roger said, resigned.
Mm-hmm, said Jamie, satisfied.
Stop doing that, Brianna said crossly.
Fine. So you and Tom Christie are going to Cross Creek.
Why is Archbug going?
Roger became aware, in a subliminally marital way, that his wife was disgruntled at the thought of being left behind to organise the harvest. A filthy, exhausting job at the best of times, whilst he frolicked with a squad of his co-religionists in the romantically exciting metropolis of Cross Creek, population 200.
It will be Arch, mostly, helping them to settle and build themselves shelter before the cold,
Jamie said logically.
You dinna mean to suggest, I hope, that I send him alone to talk to them.
Brianna smiled involuntarily at that. Arch Bug, married for decades to the voluble Mrs. Bug, was famous for his lack of speech. He could talk, but seldom did so, limiting his conversational contributions to the occasional genial,
Well, they'll likely never realise that Arch is Catholic,
Roger said, rubbing his upper lip with a forefinger.
Or is he? Come to that. I've never asked him.
He is, Jamie said very dryly. But he's lived long enough to ken when to be silent.
Well, I can see this is going to be a jolly expedition,
Brianna said, raising one brow.
When do you think you'll be back?
Christ, I don't know,
Roger said, feeling a stab of guilt at the casual blasphemy. He'd have to revise his habits and quickly.
A month? 6 weeks?
At least, his father-in-law said cheerfully.
They'll be on foot, mind.
Roger took a deep breath, contemplating a slow march, en masse, from Cross Creek to the mountains, with Archbug on one side of him, and Tom Christie on the other, twin pillars of taciturnity. His eyes lingered wistfully on his wife, envisioning 6 weeks of sleeping by the roadside, alone.
Yeah, fine, he said. I'll, go speak to Tom and Arch tonight, then.
Daddy, go?
Catching the gist of the conversation, Jem scrambled off his grandfather's knee and scampered over to Roger, grabbing him round the leg.
Go with you, Daddy.
Oh, well, I don't think.
He caught sight of Bree's face, resigned, and then the green and red jar on the table behind her.
Why not?
He said suddenly, and smiled at Jem.
great-auntie Jocasta would love to see you. And Mummy can blow things up to her heart's content without worrying where you are, eh?
She can do what?
Jamie looked startled.
It doesn't explode, Brianna said, picking up the jar of phosphorus and cradling it possessively. It just burns.
Are you sure?
This last was addressed to Roger and accompanied by a searching look.
Yeah, sure, he said, affecting confidence.
He glanced at Jemmy, who was chanting, Go, 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 meanwhile hopping up and down like a demented popcorn kernel.
At least I'll have someone to talk to on the way.
Chapter 13. Safe Hands. It was nearly dark when Jamie came in to find me sitting at the kitchen table, head on my arms. I jerked upright at the sound of his footstep, blinking.
Are you all right, Sassenach?
He sat down on the opposite bench, eyeing me.
You look as though you've been dragged through a hedge backward.
Oh. I patted vaguely at my hair, which did seem to be sticking out a bit.
Fine.
Are you hungry?
Of course I am. Have you eaten yourself?
I squinted and rubbed my face, trying to think. No, I decided at last. I was waiting for you, but I seem to have fallen asleep. There's stew. Mrs. Bug left it.
He got up and peered into the small cauldron, then pushed the swinging hook back to bring it over the fire to warm.
What have you been doing, Sassenach? He asked, coming back. And how's the wee lass?
The wee lass is what I've been doing, I said, suppressing a yawn. Mostly.
I rose, slowly, feeling my joints protest, and staggered over to the sideboard to cut some bread.
She couldn't keep it down, I said. The gallberry medicine.
Not that I blame her, I added, cautiously licking my lower lip.
After she'd thrown it up the first time, I tasted it myself. My taste buds were still in a state of revolt. I'd never met a more aptly named plant, and being boiled into a syrup had merely concentrated the flavour.
Jamie sniffed deeply as I turned.
Did she vomit on you?
No, that was Bobby Higgins, I said. He's got hookworms.
He raised his brows.
Do I want to hear about them while I'm eating?
Definitely not, I said, sitting down with the loaf, a knife, and a crock of soft butter. I tore off a piece, buttered it thickly, and gave it to him, then took one for myself. My taste buds hesitated, but wavered on the edge of forgiving me for the gallberry syrup.
What have you been doing? I asked, beginning to wake up enough to take notice. He seemed tired, but more cheerful than he had been when he'd left the house.
Talking to Roger Mack about Indians and Protestants.
He frowned at the half-eaten chunk of bread in his hand.
Is there something amiss with the bread, Sassenach? It tastes odd.
I waved a hand apologetically. Sorry, that's me. I washed several times, but I couldn't get it off completely. Perhaps you'd better do the buttering.
I pushed the loaf toward him with my elbow, gesturing at the crock.
Couldn't I get what off?
Well, we tried and tried with the syrup, but no good. Lizzie simply couldn't hold it down, poor thing. But then I remembered that quinine can be absorbed through the skin, so I mixed the syrup into some goose grease and rubbed it all over her.
Oh, yes, thanks.
I leaned forward and took a delicate bite of the buttered bit of bread he held out for me. My taste buds gave in gracefully, and I realized that I hadn't eaten all day.
And it worked.
He glanced up at the ceiling. Mr. Weems and Lizzie shared the smaller room upstairs, but all was quiet above.
I think so, I said, swallowing. The fever finally broke, at least, and she's asleep. We'll keep using it. If the fever doesn't come back in 2 days, we'll know it works.
That's good, then.
Well, and then there was Bobby and his hookworms. Fortunately, I have some ipecacuanha and turpentine.
Fortunately for the worms or for Bobby?
Well, neither really, I said, and yawned. It will probably work, though. He smiled faintly and uncorked a bottle of beer, passing it automatically under his nose. Finding it all right, he poured some for me.
Aye, well, it's a comfort to know I'm leaving things in your capable hands, Sassenach. Ill-smelling, he added, wrinkling his long nose in my direction, but capable.
Thanks so much.
The beer was better than good. Must be one of Mrs. Bug's batches.
We sipped companionably for a bit, both too tired to get up and serve the stew.
I watched him beneath my lashes. I always did when he was about to leave on a journey, storing up small memories of him against his return.
He looked tired, and there were small twin lines between his heavy brows, betokening slight worry. The candlelight glowed on the broad bones of his face, though, and cast his shadow clear on the plastered wall behind him, strong and bold. I watched the shadow raise its spectral beer glass, the light making an amber glow in the shadow glass.
Sassenach, he said suddenly, putting down the glass. How many times would you say have I come close to dying?
I stared at him for a moment, but then shrugged and began to reckon, mustering my synapses into reluctant activity. Well, I don't know what horrible things happened to you before I met you, but after... Well, you were dreadfully ill at the Abbey. I glanced covertly at him, but he seemed not to be bothered at the thought of Wentworth Prison and what had been done to him there that had caused the illness.
And after Culloden, you said you had a terrible fever then from your wounds and thought you might die, only Jenny forced you... I mean... nursed you through it.
And then Lyra shot me, he said wryly, and you forced me through it. Likewise, when the snake bit me.
He considered for a moment.
I had the smallpox when I was a wean, but I think I wasn't in danger of dying then. They said it was a light case. So only four times then.
What about the day I first met you? I objected. You nearly bled to death.
Oh, I did not, he protested. That was no but a wee scratch.
I lifted one brow at him, and leaning over to the hearth, scooped a ladle of aromatic stew into a bowl. It was rich with the juices of rabbit and venison, swimming in a thick gravy spiced with rosemary, garlic, and onion. So far as my taste buds were concerned, all was forgiven. Have it your way, I said, but wait... What about your head? When Dougal tried to kill you with an axe. Surely that's five.
He frowned, accepting the ball.
Aye, I suppose you're right, he said, seeming displeased. Five, then.
I regarded him gently over my own bowl of stew. He was very large, solid, and beautifully formed. And if he was a bit battered by circumstance... That merely added to his charm. "You're a very hard person to kill, I think," I said. "That's a great comfort to me." He smiled, reluctant, but then reached out and lifted his glass in salute, touching it first to his own lips, then to mine.
"We'll drink to that, Sassenach, shall we?"
Chapter 14 People of the Snowbird.
Guns,
Bird Who Sings in the Morning said.
Tell your king we want guns.
Jamie suppressed the urge to reply, who doesn't, for a moment, but then gave in to it, surprising the war chief into a blink of startlement, followed by a grin.
Who indeed?
Bird was a short man, shaped like a barrel, and young for his office. But shrewd. His affability no disguise to his intelligence.
They all tell you this? All the village war chiefs, eh? Of course they do. What do you tell them?
What I can.
Jamie lifted one shoulder, let it fall.
Trade goods are certain, knives are likely. Guns are possible, but I cannot yet promise them.
They were speaking a slightly unfamiliar dialect of Cherokee, and he hoped he had got right the manner of indicating probability. He did well enough with the usual tongue in casual matters of trade and hunting, but the matters he dealt in here wouldn't be casual. He glanced briefly at Ian, who was listening closely, but evidently what he said was all right. Ian visited the villages near the ridge frequently and hunted with the young men. He shifted into the tongue of the Jalagi as easily as he did into his native Gaelic.
So, well enough.
Bird settled himself more comfortably. The pewter badge Jamie had given him as a present glinted on his breast, firelight flickering over the broadly amiable planes of his face.
Tell your king about the guns. And tell him why we need them, eh?
You wish me to tell him that, do you?
Do you think he will be willing to send you guns with which to kill his own people?
Jamie asked dryly. The incursion of white settlers across the treaty line into the Cherokee lands was a sore point, and he risked something by alluding to it directly, rather than addressing Bird's other needs for guns, to defend his village from raiders, or to go raiding himself. Bird shrugged in reply.
We can kill them without guns, if we want to.
One eyebrow lifted a little, and Bird's lips pursed, waiting to see what Jamie made of this statement. He supposed Bird meant to shock him. He merely nodded.
Of course you can. You are wise enough not to. Not yet.
Bird's lips relaxed into a charming smile.
You tell the king, not yet. His Majesty will be pleased to hear that you value his friendship so much.
Bird burst into laughter at that, rocking back and forth, and his brother, Stillwater, who sat beside him, grinned broadly.
I like you, Bear Killer, he said, recovering. You're a funny man. I may be, Jamie said in English, smiling. Give it time.
Ian gave a small snort of amusement at that, causing Bird to look sharply at him, then away, clearing his throat. Jamie raised one brow at his nephew, who replied with a bland smile. Stillwater was watching Ian narrowly. The Cherokee welcomed them both with respect, but Jamie had noticed at once a particular edge in their response to Ian. They perceived Ian to be Mohawk, and he made them wary. In all honesty, he himself sometimes thought there was some part of Ian that hadn't come back from Snake Town, and perhaps never would. Bird had given him an avenue to inquire about something, though.
You have been much troubled by persons who come into your lands to settle, he said, nodding sympathetically. You, of course, do not kill these persons, being wise. But not everyone is wise, are they?
Bird's eyes narrowed briefly.
What do you mean, Bear Killer? I hear of burning, Tsisqua.
He held the other man's eyes with his own, careful to give no hint of accusation.
The king hears of houses burning, men killed and women taken. This does not please him.
Hmm, Bird said, and pressed his lips together. He did not, however, say he hadn't heard of such things himself, which was interesting.
Enough of such stories, and the king may send soldiers to protect his people. If he should do that, he will hardly wish to have them face guns that he himself has given,
Jamie pointed out logically.
And what should we do then? Stillwater broke in hotly. They come across the treaty line, build houses, plant fields, and take the game. If your king cannot keep his people where they belong, how can he protest if we defend our lands?
Bird made a small flattening gesture with one hand, not looking at his brother, and Stillwater subsided, though with bad grace.
So, Bear Killer, you will tell the king these things, will you?
Jamie inclined his head gravely.
That is my office. I speak of the king to you, and I will take your words to the king.
Bird nodded thoughtfully, then waved a hand for food and beer, and the talk changed firmly to neutral matters.
No more business would be done tonight.
It was late when they left Tsisqua's house for the small guest house. He thought it was well past moonrise, but there was no moon to be seen. The sky glowed thick with cloud, and the scent of rain was live on the wind.
"Oh, God," Ian said, yawning and stumbling. "My bum's gonna sleep."
Jamie yawned too, finding it contagious, but then blinked and laughed.
"Oh, well, dinna bother waking it up. The rest of you can join it."
Ian made a derisive noise with his lips.
"Just because Bird says you're a funny man, Uncle Jamie, I wouldna go believing it. He's only being polite, Ken."
Jamie ignored this, murmuring thanks in Jalagi to the young woman who had shown them the way to their quarters. She handed him a small basket, filled with cornbread and dried apples from the smell, then wished them a soft, "Good night, sleep well," before vanishing into the damp, restless night. The small hut seemed stuffy after the cool freshness of the air, and he stood in the doorway for a moment, enjoying the movement of the wind through the trees, watching it snake through the pine boughs like a huge invisible serpent. A spatter of moisture bloomed on his face, and he experienced the deep pleasure of a man who realizes that it's going to rain and that he isn't going to have to spend the night out in it.
"Ask about, Ian, when you're gossiping tomorrow," he said, ducking inside. "Let it be known tactfully that the king would be pleased to know exactly who in hell's been burning cabins, and might be pleased enough to cough up a few guns in reward. They'll not tell you if it's them that's been doing it, but if it's another band, they might."
Ian nodded, yawning again. A small fire burned in a stone ring, the smoke of it wisping up toward a smoke hole in the roof overhead, and by its light, a fur-piled sleeping platform was visible across one side of the hut, with another stack of furs and blankets on the floor.
"Toss you for the bed, Uncle Jamie," he said, digging in the pouch at his waist and coming out with a battered shilling. "Call it."
"Tails," Jamie said, setting down the basket and unbelting his plaid.
It fell in a warm puddle of fabric round his legs, and he shook out his shirt. The linen was creased and grimy against his skin, and he could smell himself.
Thank God this was the last of the villages. One more night, perhaps, two at the most, and they could go home.
Ian swore, picking up the coin.
"How'd you do that? Every night you've said tails, and every night tails it is."
"Well, it's your shilling, Ian. Dinna blame me."
He sat down on the bed platform and stretched himself pleasurably, then relented.
"Look at Geordie's nose."
Ian flipped the shilling over in his fingers and held it to the light of the fire, squinting, then swore again. A tiny splotch of beeswax, so thin as to be invisible, unless you were looking, ornamented the aristocratically prominent nose of George III, Rex Britannia.
"How did that get there?"
Ian narrowed his eyes suspiciously at his uncle, but Jamie merely laughed and lay down.
"When you were showing wee Jim how to spin a coin. Remember, he knocked the candlestick over. Hot wax went everywhere."
"Oh."
Ian sat looking at the coin in his hand for a moment, then shook his head, scraped the wax away with a thumbnail, and put the shilling away.
"Good night, Uncle Jimmy,"
he said, sliding onto the furs on the ground with a sigh.
"Good night, Ian."
He had been ignoring his tiredness, holding it like Gideon on a short rein. Now he dropped the reins and gave it leave to carry him off, his body relaxing into the comfort of the bed.
MacDonald, he reflected cynically, would be delighted. Jamie had planned on visits only to the two Cherokee villages closest to the treaty line, there to announce his new position, distribute modest gifts of whiskey and tobacco, this last hastily borrowed from Tom Christie, who had fortunately purchased a hogshead of the weed on a seed-buying trip to Cross Creek, and informed the Cherokee that further largesse might be expected when he undertook ambassage to the more distant villages in the autumn. He had been most cordially received in both villages, but in the second, Pigtown, several strangers had been visiting, young men in search of wives. They were from a separate band of Cherokee,
called the Snowbird Band, whose large village lay higher in the mountains. One of the young men had been the nephew of Bird Who Sings in the Morning, head man of the Snowbird Band, and had been exigent in pressing Jamie to return with him and his companions to their home village. Taking a hasty private inventory of his remaining whiskey and tobacco, Jamie had agreed, and he and Ian had been most royally received there as agents of His Majesty. The Snowbird had never been visited by an Indian agent before, and appeared most sensible of the honour, and prompt about seeing what advantages might accrue to themselves in consequence. He thought Bird was the sort of man with whom he could do business, though, on various fronts. That thought led him to belated recollection of Roger Mack and the new tenants. He'd had no time over the last few days to spare much worry there, but he doubted there was any cause for concern. Roger Mack was capable enough, though his shattered voice made him less certain than he should be. With Christie and Arch Bug, though. He closed his eyes, the bliss of absolute fatigue stealing over him as his thoughts grew more disjointed.
A day more, maybe, then home in time to make the hay. Another malting, too, maybe, before the cold weather. Slaughtering. Could it be time at last to kill that damned white sow? No, the vicious creature was unbelievably fecund. What kind of boar had the balls to mate with her? He wondered dimly. And did she eat him after? Wild boar. Smoked hams. Blood pudding.
He was just drifting down through the first layers of sleep when he felt a hand on his privates.
Jerked out of drowsiness like a salmon out of a sea loch, he clapped a hand to the intruders, gripping tight,
and elicited a faint giggle from his visitor. Feminine fingers wiggled gently in his grasp, and the hand's fellow promptly took up operations in its stead. His first coherent thought was that the lassie would be an excellent baker, so good as she was at kneading. Other thoughts followed rapidly on the heels of this absurdity, and he tried to grab the second hand. It playfully eluded him in the dark, poking and tweaking. He groped for a polite protest in Cherokee, but came up with nothing but a handful of random phrases in English and Gaelic, none of them faintly suitable to the occasion. The first hand was purposefully wriggling out of his grasp, eel-like. Reluctant to crush her fingers, he let go for an instant and made a successful grab for her wrist.
"Ian!" he hissed in desperation. "Ian! Are you there?"
He couldn't see his nephew in the pool of darkness that filled the cabin, nor tell if he slept. There were no windows, and only the faintest light came from the dying coals.
"Ian!"
There was a stirring on the floor, bodies shifting, and he heard Rollo sneeze.
"What is it, Uncle?"
He'd spoken in Gaelic, and Ian answered in the same language. The lad sounded calm. Not as though he'd just come awake.
"Ian, there is a woman in my bed," he said in Gaelic, trying to match his nephew's calm tone. "There are two of them, Uncle Jamie."
Ian sounded amused, damn him. "The other will be down by your feet, waiting her turn." That unnerved him, and he nearly lost his grip on the captive hand.
"Two of them? What do they think I am?"
The girl giggled again, leaned over, and bit him lightly on the chest.
"Christ!" "Well, no, Uncle, they don't think you're him," Ian said, obviously suppressing his own mirth. "They think you're the king, so to speak. You're his agent, so they're doing honour to His Majesty by sending you his women, aye?"
The second woman had uncovered his feet and was slowly stroking his soles with one finger. He was ticklish, and would have found this bothersome were he not so distracted by the first woman, with whom he was being compelled into a most undignified game of hide the sausage.
"Talk to them, Ian," he said between clenched teeth, fumbling madly with his free hand, meanwhile forcing back the questing fingers of the captive hand,
which were languidly stroking his ear, and wiggling his feet in a frantic effort to discourage the second lady's attentions, which were growing bolder.
What do you want me to say?
Ian inquired, switching back to English. His voice quivered slightly.
Tell them I'm deeply sensible of the honour, but...
Further diplomatic evasions were cut off by the sudden intrusion of someone's tongue into his mouth, tasting strongly of onions and beer. In the midst of his subsequent struggles, he was dimly aware that Ian had lost any sense of self-control and was lying on the floor, giggling helplessly. It was filicide if you killed a son, he thought grimly. What was the word for assassinating a nephew?
Madam, he said, disengaging his mouth with difficulty.
He seized the lady by the shoulders and rolled her off his body with enough force that she whooped with surprise, bare legs flying.
Jesus, was she naked?
She was. Both of them were. His eyes adapted to the faint glow of the embers, he caught the shimmering of light from shoulders, breasts, and rounded thighs. He sat up, gathering furs and blankets round him in a sort of hasty redoubt.
"Cease, the two of you," he said severely in Cherokee. "You are beautiful, but I cannot lie with you."
"No," said one, sounding puzzled. "Why not?" said the other.
Because there is an oath upon me," he said, necessity producing inspiration. "I have sworn...
He groped for the proper word, but didn't find it. Luckily, Ian leapt in at this point with a stream of fluent jalagi, too fast to follow.
"Oh,"
breathed one girl, impressed. Jamie felt a distinct qualm.
"What in God's name did you tell them, Ian?"
"I told them the Great Spirit came to you in a dream, Uncle, and told you that you mustn't go with a woman until you'd brought guns to all the jalagi."
"Until I what?" "Well, that was the best I could think of in a hurry, Uncle," Ian said defensively.
Hair-raising as the notion was, he had to admit it was effective. The two women were huddled together, whispering in awed tones, and had quite left off pestering him.
"Aye, well," he said grudgingly, "I suppose it could be worse."
After all, even if the Crown were persuaded to provide guns, there were a damn lot of jalagi.
"You're welcome, Uncle Jamie."
The laughter was gurgling just below the surface of his nephew's voice, and emerged in a stifled snort.
"What?"
he said testily.
"The one lady is saying it's a disappointment to her, Uncle, because you're very nicely equipped. The other is more philosophical about it, though. She says they might have borne ye children, and that the bairns might have red hair."
His nephew's voice quivered.
"What's wrong with red hair, for God's sake?"
"I dunno ken quite, but I gather it's not something you want your bairn to be marked with, and you can help it."
"Well, fine," he snapped. "No danger of it, is there? Can they not go home now?"
"It's raining, Uncle Jimmy,"
Ian pointed out logically. It was. The wind had brought a patter of rain, and now the main shower arrived, beating on the roof with a steady thrum, drops hissing into the hot embers through the smoke hole.
"You wouldn't have sent them out in the wet, would you? Besides, you just said you couldn't lie with them.
Not that you meant them to go."
He broke off to say something interrogative to the ladies, who replied with eager confidence. Jamie thought they'd said... they had. Rising with the grace of young cranes, the two of them clambered naked as jaybirds back into his bed, patting and stroking him with murmurs of admiration, though sedulously avoiding his private parts, pressed him down into the furs, and snuggled down on either side of him, warm, bare flesh pressed cozily against him. He opened his mouth, then shut it again, finding absolutely nothing to say in any of the languages he knew. He lay on his back, rigid and breathing shallowly. His cock throbbed indignantly, clearly meaning to stay up and torment him all night in revenge for its abuse. Small chortling noises came from the pile of furs on the ground, interspersed with hiccuping snorts. He thought it was maybe the first time he'd heard Ian truly laugh since his return. Praying for fortitude, he drew a long, slow breath and closed his eyes, hands folded firmly across his ribs, elbows pressed to his sides. Chapter 15. Stick it to June. Roger walked out onto the terrace at River Run, feeling pleasantly exhausted. After 3 weeks of strenuous work, he'd gathered the new tenants from the highways and byways of Cross Creek and Campbellton, become acquainted with all the heads of households, managed to equip them at least minimally for the journey in terms of food, blankets and shoes, and got them all collected in one place, firmly overcoming their tendency to panic and stray. They'd start in the morning for Fraser's Ridge, and not a moment too soon. He looked out over the terrace in satisfaction, toward the meadow that lay beyond Jocasta Cameron Innes's stables. They were all bedded down in a temporary camp there. 22 families with 76 individual souls, 4 mules, 2 ponies, 14 dogs, 3 pigs, and God only knew how many chickens, kittens and pet birds bundled into wicker cages for carrying. He had all the names on a list, animals excluded, dog-eared and crumpled in his pocket. He had several other lists there as well, scribbled over, crossed out, and amended to the point of illegibility. He felt like a walking book of Deuteronomy. He also felt like a very large drink. This was luckily forthcoming. Duncan Innes, Jocasta's husband, had returned from his own day's labour and was sitting on the terrace in company with a cut-glass decanter from which the rays of the sinking sun struck a mellow amber glow.
"How is it then, Harwich?"
Duncan greeted him genially, gesturing toward one of the basketwork chairs.
"You'll take a dram, perhaps?" "I will, and thanks."
He sank gratefully into the chair, which creaked amiably beneath his weight. He accepted the glass Duncan handed him and tossed it back with a brief slunch. The whiskey burned through the strictures that bound his throat, making him cough, but seeming suddenly to open things so that the constant faint sense of choking began to leave him. He sipped, grateful.
"Ready to go, are they?"
Duncan nodded toward the meadow, where the smoke of campfires hung in a low golden haze.
"Ready as I'll ever be, poor things," Roger added, with some sympathy.
Duncan raised one shaggy brow.
"Fish out of water," Roger amplified, holding out his glass to accept the proffered refill. "The women are terrified, and so are the men, but they hide it better. You'd think I was taking them all to be slaves on a sugar plantation."
Duncan nodded.
"Or sell them to Rome to clean the Pope's shoon," he said wryly. "I misdoubt most of them had ever smelt a Catholic before embarking. And from the wrinkled noses, they dinna care so much for the scent now, I think. Do they so much as tak a dram now and then, d'ye ken?" "Only medicinally, and only if in actual danger of death, I think."
Roger took a slow ambrosial swallow and closed his eyes, feeling the whiskey warm his throat and curl in his chest like a purring cat.
"Meet Hiram yet, did you? Hiram Crombie, the head man of this lot?" "The wee sewer drap wi' a stick up his ass. Aye, I met him," Duncan grinned, his drooping moustache lifting at the end. "He'll be at supper with us. Best have another."
"I will, thanks," said Roger, extending his glass. "Though they're none of them much for hedonistic pleasure, so far as I can tell. You'd think they were all still covenanters to the bone. The frozen chosen, eh?"
Duncan laughed immoderately at that.
"Well, it's no like it was in my grandsire's day," he said, recovering and reaching across for the decanter. "And thank the Lord for that."
He rolled his eyes, grimacing.
"Your grandsire was a covenanter then?" "God, yes."
Shaking his head, Duncan poured a goodly measure, first for Roger,
then himself.
A fierce old bastard he was. Not that he'd no cause, mind. His sister was stick it to Drunken. Was Christ!
He bit his tongue in penance, but was far too interested to pay it much mind.
You mean executed by drowning?
Duncan nodded, eyes on his glass, then took a good gulp and held it for a moment in his mouth before swallowing.
Margaret, he said. Her name was Margaret. 18 she was at the time. Her father and her brother, my grandfather, they'd fled after the battle at Dunbar, hid in the hills. The troops came a-hunting them, but she wouldn't say where they'd gone. And she had a Bible by her. They tried to make her recant then, but she wouldn't do that either. The women on that side of the family might as well talk to a stone, he said, shaking his head. There's no moving them. But they dragged her down to the shore, her and an old Covenanter woman from the village, stripped them and tied them both to stakes at the tide line. Waited there, the crowd of them, for the water to come in.
He took another swallow, not waiting for the taste of it.
The old woman went under first. They'd tied her closer to the water, I suppose, thinking Margaret would give in if she saw the old woman die.
He grunted, shaking his head.
But nay, not a bit of it.
The tide rose, and the waves came up over her. She choked, and she coughed, and her hair loose, hanging over her face, plastered down like kelp when the water went out.
My mother saw it, he explained, lifting his glass. She was but 7 at the time, but she never forgot.
After the first wave, she said, there was the space of 3 breaths, and the wave came o'er Margaret again,
and then out 3 breaths, and in again once more. And you couldn't see anything then but the swirl of her hair floating on the tide.
He raised his glass an inch higher, and Roger lifted his own in involuntary toast.
Jesus, he said,
and it was no blasphemy. The whiskey burned his throat as it went down, and he breathed deep, giving thanks to God for the gift of air. 3 breaths. It was the single malt of Isla, and the iodine taste of sea and kelp was strong and smoky in his lungs.
May God give her peace, he said, his voice rasping.
Duncan nodded and reached again for the decanter.
I would suppose she earned it, he said, though they,
he pointed with his chin toward the meadow,
they'd say 'twas none of her own doing at all. God chose her for salvation, and chose the English to be damned. Nae more to be said on the matter.
The light was fading, and the campfires began to glow in the dimness of the meadow beyond the stables. The smoke of them reached Roger's nose, the scent warm and homelike, but nonetheless adding to the burn in his throat.
I've no found so much worth dying for myself, Duncan said reflectively,
then gave one of his quick, rare smiles.
But my grandsire, he'd say it only meant I was chosen to be damned. By the decree of God for his everlasting glory, some men and angels are predestined unto everlasting life, and others foreordained to everlasting death. He'd say that whenever anyone spoke of Margaret.
Roger nodded, recognising the statement from the Westminster Confession. When was that? 1646? 1647? A generation, or two, before Duncan's grandfather.
I expect it was easier for him to think her death was God's will and nothing to do with him, Roger said, not without sympathy. You'll not believe it yourself, then. Predestination, I mean.
He asked with true curiosity. The Presbyterians of his own time did still espouse predestination as a doctrine, but a bit more flexible in attitude tended to soft-pedal the notion of predestined damnation, and not to think too much on the idea that every detail of life was so predestined. Himself, God knew. Duncan lifted his shoulders,
the right rising higher and making him seem momentarily twisted.
"God knows," he said, and laughed.
He shook his head and drained his glass again.
"Nay, I think I don't. But I wouldna say as much before Hiram Crombie, nor yet yon Christie."
Duncan lifted his chin toward the meadow, where he could see two dark figures walking side by side toward the house. Archbug's tall, stooped frame was easy to recognize, as was Tom Christie's shorter, blocky build. He looked pugnacious, even in silhouette, Roger thought, making short, sharp gestures as he walked, clearly arguing something with Arch.
"There'd be wicked fights over it sometimes in Ardsmuir," Duncan said, watching the progress of the two figures. "The Catholics took it amiss to be told they were damned, and Christie and his wee band took the greatest pleasure in telling them so."
His shoulders shook a little in suppressed laughter, and Roger wondered just how much whiskey Duncan had had before he came out to the terrace. He'd never seen the older man so jovial.
"MacDo put a stop to it, finally, when he made us all be Freemasons," he added, leaning forward to pour a fresh glass. "But a few men were nearly killed before that."
He lifted the decanter inquiringly in Roger's direction.
"Looking forward to a supper, including both Tom Christie and Hiram Crombie," Roger accepted.
As Duncan leaned toward him to pour, still smiling, the last of the sun shone across his weathered face. Roger caught a glimpse of a faint white line through Duncan's upper lip, half visible beneath the hair, and realized quite suddenly why Duncan wore a long moustache, an unusual adornment in a time when most men were clean-shaven. He wouldn't have spoken, likely, save for the whiskey and the mood of strange alliance between them. Two Protestants amazingly bound to Catholics and bemused at the strange tides of fate that had washed over them. Two men left quite alone by the misfortunes of life and now surprised to find themselves the heads of households, holding the lives of strangers in their hands.
"Your lip, Duncan."
He touched his own mouth briefly.
"What did that?" "Och, lad."
Duncan touched his own lip, surprised.
"Nay, I was born with a hare lip." "Oh, so they said. I dinna recall it myself. It was men did when I was nae more than a week old."
It was Roger's turn to be surprised.
"Who mended it?"
Duncan shrugged, one shoulder this time.
"Travelling healer, my mother said. She'd quite resigned herself to losing me, she said, because I couldna suck, of course. She and my aunties all took it in turn to drop milk into my mouth from a rag, but she said I'd wasted nearly to a wee skeleton when this charmer came by the village."
He rubbed a knuckle self-consciously over his lip, smoothing the thick, grizzled hairs of his moustache.
"My father gave him 6 herrings and a mull of snuff, and he stitched it up. I gave my mother a bit of some ointment to put on the wound. Well, and so..."
He shrugged again, with a lopsided smile.
"Perhaps I was destined to live after all. My grandsire said the Lord had chosen me. Though God only kens what for."
Roger was conscious of a faint ripple of unease, dulled though it was by whiskey. A Highland charmer who could repair a hare lip? He took another drink, trying not to stare, but covertly examining Duncan's face. He supposed it was possible. The scar was just barely visible, if you knew to look, under Duncan's moustache, but didn't extend up into the nostril. It must have been a fairly simple hare lip, then, not one of the hideous cases like that one he'd read about, unable to look away from the page for horror in Claire's big black doctor's book, where Dr. Rawlings had described a child born not only with a split lip, but missing the roof of its mouth, and most of the centre of its face as well. There had been no drawing, thank God, but the visual picture conjured up by Rawlings' spare description had been bad enough. He closed his eyes and breathed deeply, inhaling the whiskey's perfume through his pores.
Was it possible? Perhaps. People did do surgery now,
blood-stained, crude and agonising as it was. He'd seen Murray MacLeod, the apothecary from Campbellton, expertly stitch up a man's cheek, laid open when the man was trampled by a sheep. Would it be any more difficult to stitch a child's mouth?
He thought of Jemmy's lip, tender as a blossom, pierced by needle and black thread, and shuddered.
"Are you cold there in the Harwich? Shall we go in?"
Duncan got his feet under him as though to rise, but Roger waved the older man back.
"Oh, no. Goose walking on my grave."
He smiled and accepted another drop to keep the non-existent evening chill away. Yet he felt the hairs on his arms rise just a little.
Could there be another one? More? Like us? There had been, he knew. His own multiple times great-grandmother Gilles, for one. The man whose skull Claire had found, complete with silver fillings in its teeth, for another. But had Duncan met another in some remote Highland village half a century before?
Christ, he thought, freshly unnerved. How often does it happen? And what happens to them?
Before they had quite reached the bottom of the decanter, he heard footsteps behind him and the rustle of silk.
Mrs. Cameron!
He rose at once, the world tilting just a little, and took his hostess's hand, bowing over it. Her long hand touched his face, as was her habit, her sensitive fingertips confirming his identity.
Oh, there you are, Joe. Had a good journey with the wee lad, did you?
Duncan struggled to rise, handicapped by whiskey and his single arm. But Ulysses, Jocasta's butler, had materialised silently out of the twilight behind his mistress in time to move her wicker chair into place. She sank into it without so much as putting a hand out to see that it was there, Roger noticed. She simply knew it would be. Roger viewed the butler with interest, wondering who Jocasta had bribed to get him back. Accused, and very likely guilty, of the death of a British naval officer on Jocasta's property, Ulysses had been forced to flee the colony. But Lieutenant Wolfe had not been considered a great loss to the Navy, and Ulysses was indispensable to Jocasta Cameron. All things might not be possible with gold, but he was willing to bet that Jocasta Cameron hadn't yet met a circumstance she couldn't mend with money, political connections, or guile.
"Oh, aye," she replied to her husband, smiling and putting out a hand to him. "'Twas such fun to show him off, husband. We'd a wonderful luncheon with old Mrs. Forbes and her daughter, and the wee bairn sang a song and charmed them all. Mrs. Forbes had the Montgomery lasses in as well, and Miss Ogilvy, and we had wee lamb cutlets with raspberry sauce and fried apples, and, oh, is that you, Mr. Christie? Do come and join us."
She raised her voice a little, and her face, appearing to look expectantly into the gloom over Roger's shoulder.
"Mrs. Cameron, your servant, madam."
Christie stepped up onto the terrace, making a courtly bow that was no less punctilious for the fact that its recipient was blind. Archbug followed him, bowing in turn over Jocasta's hand, and making a genial noise in his throat by way of greeting. Chairs were brought out, more whiskey, a plate of savouries appeared as by magic, candles were lit, and suddenly it was a party, echoing on a higher plane the sense of slightly nervous festivity taking place in the meadow below. There was music in the distance, the sound of a tin whistle playing a jig. Roger let it all wash over him, enjoying the brief sense of relaxation and irresponsibility. Just for tonight, there was no need to worry. Everyone was gathered, safe, fed, and prepared for the morrow's journey. He needn't even trouble to keep up his end of the conversation. Tom Christie and Jocasta were enthusiastically discussing the literary scene in Edinburgh, and a book he'd never heard of, with Duncan, looking so mellow that he might slide out of his chair any minute, putting in the occasional remark, and old Arch. Where was Arch? Oh, there. Gone back towards the meadow,
having doubtless thought of some last-minute thing he must tell someone. He blessed Jamie Fraser for his forethought in sending Arch and Tom with him. Between the two of them, they'd saved him from any number of blunders, managed the 10,000 necessary details, and eased the fears of the new tenants regarding this latest leap into the unknown. He took a deep, contented breath of air, scented with the homely smells of campfires in the distance, and roasting dinner near at hand, and belatedly recalled the one small detail whose welfare was still his exclusive concern. Excusing himself, he made his way into the house and discovered Jem down below in the main kitchen, cosily ensconced in a corner of a settle, eating bread pudding with melted butter and maple syrup on it.
"That's never your dinner, is it?"
he asked, sitting down beside his son.
"Uh-huh. Want some, Daddy?"